ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There's only one China, and Taiwan is part of China.
Taiwan is a cork in a bottle. Whoever controls Taiwan controls the cork in that bottle.
Taiwan on the front line.
Taiwan's a country! It's my country!
That was a dramatic taste of Monday's Four Corners episode, which looked at frontline Taiwan. The small island state has been, well, a geopolitical hotspot, the centre of a power struggle between Washington and Beijing. But it's much more than that. Taiwan is a proud democratic tradition. It's a digital hub and the heart of the world's semiconductor supply chain. So for our Asia update tonight, I'm joined by two guests, both currently in Taiwan. Wen Tu Sung is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and a Taiwan expert at the ANU. And Cheng Ting Lung Fung, or Annie as I'm permitted to call her, is the chief tech correspondent with Nikkei Asia. I welcome you both. When Taiwan became the centre of attention at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore last week, explain who was there and what happened.
Well, the Shangri-La Dialogue is basically like the Oscars for Asian security every summer. Every year around June or so, you get government leaders, defense and foreign ministry officials, as well as political scholars and think tankers, all gathering around for a long weekend where they talk about regional security issues around the Indo-Pacific. Australia's own Prime Minister Albanese gave a keynote this year. And of course, the defense minister from US and China, the two big superpowers, both attended it as well. So naturally, people were, before the event, people were anticipating they're going to be watching for how tough is going to be the attitude for from US and China, and whether US and China's defense ministers will actually meet in person to have a one-on-one meeting. One-on-one with aides, of course, because if they do, that will be a sign for people that maybe some kind of fall, some kind of stability in U.S.-China relations can gradually return. And so how tough are their attitudes? Tough for sure. China's defense minister talked about how they oppose Cold War mentality, how they don't like exclusive military blocs in the region, hint, AUKUS. And that China military, he pledges, is willing to pay whatever the price to prevent Taiwan separation from China. So that's an ominous word from Chinese side. And U.S. side, of course, began to still talk about Taiwan because Taiwan remains that one hotspot issue in U.S.-China relations that may have potentially greatest explosive potential. So a U.S. minister basically said that a war would be catastrophic. They don't need war, and they want to have more crisis communication with the Chinese side, e.g. in the form of a meeting between the two defense ministers, which China side was not willing to grant. So again, I think Taiwan remains at a centerpiece for these kind of regional security-oriented discussions, and it's definitely been featured on quite a few discussion panels at the dialogue. But there still isn't all that much sign just yet from definitely U.S. and U.S. and China's defense ministries about a true willingness to move towards more meaningful crisis communication and dialogue on resolving and stabilizing the issue just yet.
While this summit was happening, there was a skirmish between a Chinese and a U.S. warship in the Taiwan Straits. What did you make of that?
Yeah, there was a near miss. I think a Chinese and American warship nearly hit each other when they were patrolling somewhere in the waters not far from Taiwan. I think that just goes to show, again, the risk of accidental escalation militarily between U.S. and China, especially when we don't have that much stable, regularized dialogue happening on the higher levels between the two sides. like rationally, I think it's pretty straightforward that nobody truly want to actively plan towards a war, because a war between two nuclear armed superpowers is going to be unimaginable in consequence, including even China too, because China has enough of its own problems to deal with now, like post-COVID lockdown, economic recovery, employment crisis, so on and so forth. But again, when China sends so many, be it warships or military airplanes, into the airspace and waters around Taiwan, that will at some point, however, the risk will only get higher and higher over time, that maybe at some point, be it Taiwan side or Chinese side or American or other regional states, they may, let's say, fire a warning shot. The bullet may go astray, or that those warships at this time may fail to stop or swerve in time to avoid accidental escalation. So these are things I think, again, highlight the need for communication.
Wendy, which ship was the provocateur in this near collision?
Obviously, we're waiting for a final investigation to come out, but judging from the video we've seen from a Canadian reporter who's on the Canadian ship at the time, it would seem like Chinese warship was the one that decided to move into the U.S.'s existing path, and therefore forcing U.S. side to swerve.
Annie, you recently co-authored a great piece about how Taiwan has become indispensable as a tech hub. How did this happen?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Actually, we just released a Nikkei Asia and Financial Times joint project to look at why supply chain is so difficult to decouple and why Taiwan is such an indispensable economy, because we cover supply chain for a very long time and we always think that supply chain is long and complex. If you need 1,500 components to build an iPhone, but now you have 99% of them, your phone still cannot be shipped because of that 1% of component left out. So you see, like, every component can be very important. And what Taiwan is now so famous is that we manufacture chips. So many different kinds of chips, from CPUs, processors, power management, sensors, modems, and many more, and also the graphic processors that enable AI computing and your ChatGPT requests, and are also coming from Taiwan. And imagine this, after being done with so many chip manufacturing, you still need chip packaging and testing processes, which Taiwan also control more than 30% of global market share. Also, these chips need to be placed and mounted on the printed circuit boards, which Taiwan also has a third of global market share as an industry. So many of these components, such as the print circuit boards, are actually built by Taiwanese companies in China, so and later shipped to other suppliers in China to assemble into your laptop, TVs, and even iPhones, and then shipped all over the world. So you see, that's an overview of how the supply chain are so linked together.
Annie, does the fact that Taiwan is so important to the global economy provide it with a level of security?
Oh, actually, this Tuesday, I just went to world's leading chip maker, TSMC's annual general assembly in Hsinchu. That is Taiwan's tech hub. And in fact, one comment made by TSMC's chairman, Mark Liu, was very interesting. He said that because U.S. and China both need Taiwan's flagship chip industry and TSMC for vital chip supplies, that fact actually could help stabilize U.S.-China geopolitical tension. And if Taiwan's chip industry could continue to do well, the both sides, U.S. and China, actually will consider the consequences of a disruption. So that could in turn help calm down U.S. and China tension a bit. But of course, according to him, that does not solve the tension. And later, if I have time, I could talk about iPhone or Apple supply chain as example.
I don't think we will have time for that. But one thing, within a few days, Taiwan is it's preparing for an election. Can you give us a broad overview of the political landscape?
So Taiwan is going to be having its presidential election in January next year. It happens every 4 years. At the moment, I think this year, this time's campaign is a bit different in that usually you have two main candidates. This time around, Taiwan has three main ones. There's the ruling party, DPP, which is usually relatively pro Taiwan's national identity. And then there's the opposition party, KMT, and there's another newish young third party called Taiwan People's Party. Basically, to really oversimplify it, the ruling party at the moment is leading by double digits in this three-way race, but it's still well short of a majority. And meanwhile, the other two opposition party are fighting for second place in order to decide who gets to be the default alternative to the status quo, essentially. Usually, when it comes to presidential elections, China policy tend to be the one issue that will determine the election. But that was easier to frame it that way when you have two parties racing for the presidency. This time, with three candidates, that China policy issue may be less likely to become like the virtual referendum topic at the election.
But do they have very, very different views on how to deal with Beijing?
Indeed. So the ruling party, again, to simplify a little bit, the ruling party, DPP, is the more U.S.-friendly party, one can say, in this choice between relation for good relation with U.S. or good relation with China. DPP is the doubling down on relation with U.S. party. The other two opposition parties are the let's find a way to get along with both U.S. and China. And if that needs Taiwan to be a bit more in tune with China's preferences on Taiwan's international presence and kind of diplomatic and political language Taiwan uses, so be it.
The other interesting development that happened recently is that the US and Taiwan have signed a trade agreement. Wente, how significant is this?
It's big. I think that's probably one of the, if not the most symbolic bilateral agreement between the US and China since about 1979, when US broke off official relations with Taiwan's government. This, I think, is Taiwan's chance to, number one, increase major international visibility for once, but number two, also, it's Taiwan's consolation prize in terms of trade liberalization. Taiwan, definitely being a small economy, wants to get more access to international markets. The way to do it is to get into multilateral regional free trade agreements like the CPTPP or the RCEP. But it cannot because that's subject to vetoes by existing members, some of which may be very Beijing-friendly, so they don't want Taiwan to be in it. So when Taiwan cannot get into multilateral free trade agreements, then it's getting into a bilateral one with U.S. at the moment. So hopefully, if Taiwan and the U.S. are able to push the agreement further, that will serve as some kind of demonstration effect or good example, if you will, that can then help other economies to consider signing bilateral agreement with Taiwan as well.
Annie, I've just got time to raise another issue with you. Taiwan is having a Me Too moment. Can you talk very briefly to that?
Sure. I think it's for the very first time that the Me Too campaign actually could become a main theme of a presidential campaign and presidential election. It has actually today and recently evolved into many segments, not only in the political circle, but also to university professors, important senior editors and authors as well. So it seems it's still a snowballing event and could become one of the decisive factor and important topic during the upcoming presidential and lawmaker election.
How extraordinary. Well, thank you both. I've been talking to Wen Ti-sung, who's a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and a Taiwan expert at the ANU, and to Annie or Chen Ting-fung, who's the chief tech correspondent with Nikkei Asia. And you can find a link to that marvelous visual storytelling project she was part of in the notes to this program.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.